This is Barbara Peters. I am at the Poison Pen on March the 6th and delighted to welcome back Steve Barry for his 14th Cotton Malone book and 18th novel, the very first of which we had this conversation on a smaller scale right after in the Poison Pen.
Very small scale, as I remember.
It was, you know, but the Amber Room, Steve, was an absolutely great topic. And had I already been to Russia when we, or...
I don't think so.
Because I've been to see it since.
I think you'd seen it and you went to afterwards. But yeah, the very first, I remember sitting in the back of the store. We probably had maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 people maybe, something like that.
Listen, for a first novel, that's actually a crowd.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I was thrilled. I mean, if you're a new writer and you're out there on the road and 15, 20 people come to see you, that's a pretty big deal.
So at the time, it looked like maybe Russia was going to be kind of your theater. And you did what, one more book?
I did one more book, Romanov Prophecy with
right.
Russia. And then I switched to the Catholic Church with The Third Secret, and then I went to Templar Legacy, which changed everything.
It did.
Templar was my fourth book. It was a breakout book. It altered everything for me. It remains to this day my largest selling book.
Does it?
To this day.
You know, that's interesting. I had a conversation. I'm sorry about the phone, but there's
well,
no place
okay.
in the store
we're,
that
we're
doesn't
in a,
have
We're
one.
In a bookstore. Things are happening here, man.
I remember Steve Follett saying that, you know, it's not a similar case because everybody that he worked with tried to discourage him from writing Pillars of the Earth. But he said to this day it is still his most successful book.
It is my favorite book of his, too.
Mine too.
I love that book.
And I've never really embraced the sequels, but I love that one.
I loved Pillars of the Earth. It was just something magical about it, and he just hit all the right chords. And for me, Templar did it and kicked me up, and that's what kind of got me going. And now, with the new book, Malta, I've kind of harkened back to Templar. That's, you know, and I intentionally kind of harkened back to it a little bit.
Well, it's a very ambitious book. I was thinking, you know, when I started, you are talking about Winston Churchill and Mussolini. Actually, we're watching Mussolini meeting his inglorious end.
Mm-hmm.
And the letters between Churchill and Mussolini, which was really an interesting surprise
mm-hmm.
to me. Since you're such a great researcher, I'm going to give you credit that these are real.
Well, we don't know. We don't know. The legend is they exist. They've been searched for since the war. Churchill himself went looking for these letters in some respect. You know, no one really knows. But what we do know is that there could have been a potential embarrassment in those letters because Churchill tried to barter Malta to keep Italy out of the war. The war cabinet vetoed it. And eventually Churchill himself didn't go along with that. But it is said that he tried to barter it. Now, of course, Malta was laid siege to for 3 years. More bombs were dropped on Malta than were dropped on London. I mean, and the residents there died by the thousands, but they held. The island did not fall. And after the war, for it to be said that Churchill wanted to barter it away, it would have been incredibly embarrassing, hugely, you know, to his reputation. And that's why some say he went to Lake Como in 1945 and vacationed. We put that in quote for 3 months. An odd place to take a vacation.
But what a wonderful thing for you.
It was great for me. It's perfect for me. And you know, whether these letters exist or not, but it fit in perfectly with the whole plot leading in to where I was going with it.
Well, you're doing some very interesting things with the church, which has become even more relevant with what's going on with Pope Francis and all kinds of other things with the church. But Malta is fabulous. I have been there 3 times. And I like the capital, but there's also the older city.
Oh, I love the whole way.
Do you know that Alan Bradley, when he made such a success out of The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie, moved from Canada to Malta, probably for weather. And now he lives on the Isle of Man in the middle of the Irish Sea, but he really liked Malta, but thought it was too remote. Is there a city there that starts with a G or a little secondary island?
It was Gozo.
Gozo, that's Gozo. It. That's
Gozo.
Where he was.
Gozo
right.
is where, and I was over on Gozo. That's where the azure window is,
the
big window that's fallen in the sea. Now it's gone, but it was there when I was there. Malta's a living history museum, is what it is.
And has an incredible history of resisting, well,
Way back.
I mean, the most famous ones. So the Knights of Malta are a critical element in your new book.
That's why I said I've harkened back to the Templar legacy. The Templars are gone. The Teutonic Knights are gone. The Knights of Malta still are here. And they're 900 years old. They were called the Hospitallers, you know, and now they're the Knights of Malta. They still exist. They're headquartered in Rome. So I resurrected an aspect of them that is real, that actually did once exist within their ranks, and wove this tale around it, dealing with the church. But what I try to tell everyone is this is not a book about a secret to destroy the Catholic Church. In fact, it's just the opposite of that. Every character in the novel wants to keep the Catholic Church exactly like it is. They do not want to destroy it in any way. So it's a reverse. And I was a little cautious because religion has been done to death, in thrillers particularly. But there was one aspect of religion that no one has touched. And I noticed no one touched it, and so I did it in this novel.
I'm not going to tell what it is.
But I held it. I watched for a few years to see if anybody was going to deal with it.
Right.
And no one ever touched it, so I said, okay, I'm going then.
Yeah, there's a wonderful mystique around the papal conclave because it is so secret. I've seen, twice on television, I guess, the white smoke going up and all the rest of it. And then all the maneuvering among the princes of the church.
That's what it is. That's why they do it in secret. That's the whole point. Yeah,
it is.
They say the Holy Ghost comes down and inspires them. And that may happen. It may very well. But there's a lot of wheeling and dealing that's going on. And that's what they do. They go in and they sit down in where there's no one around. And they figure out who's going to be the best guy to lead them. And they make deals. Now, in the old days, it was corruption and bribery and all kinds of things. That's why they had a conclave, to lock them up, to make it harder to bribe them. That was the whole point of it. But today, it facilitates, you know, frank, open discussions in which you're not allowed to talk about. But they do talk about it when they come out. We do learn what goes on in a conclave, and we learn some things. And that's in here. What's shocking in the book is the financial things that I dealt with in the novel, which I didn't make up. Those are true. The Catholic Church is going through a huge internal corruption problem right now. They have serious problems inside with money and with other aspects of it that have been revealed in several books.
Some fiction and some not.
Some that's, yeah, but in the there's one particular journalist who's spent years investigating this, and I referenced the book in the back in the writer's note if they want to go take a look at it. But they have a serious problem inside the Vatican right now with money. And I wanted to bring that to everyone's attention.
And a lack of accountability. The other thing I thought you brought out that I particularly enjoyed was a reminder that the Vatican and the Holy See...
Completely different.
...are different, right.
Completely different. The Holy See is the government that governs everything. The Vatican is the religious aspect of it over to the side. The Holy See is a government. Like any government, it has waste, fraud, and abuse. And in the Vatican and in the Holy See, it's institutionalized. I mean, they actually keep double sets of books on everything. There's no way to audit anything. Anyone ever tries to audit it, it's impossible to change it. Popes have tried and tried and tried. And everyone says, well, the Pope's in charge. Not really. Really not. The Curia is in charge.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then the Vatican is actually what? Stems from the 1929 treaty
With
Italy, so that it would have this little sovereign...
Now, the Vatican is basically a geographical place.
Right, no, I've been in it. Yeah. It has its own post office and all this.
And that's what
stuff.
It means, though, when you say the Vatican, you mean that place.
Right.
The Holy See is the government that governs that place. And then, of course, there's the entity. You know, the Catholic Church has the oldest, most efficient intelligence organization in the world.
Called the entity
today. It used to be called a lot of other things. They will not acknowledge it exists, but it does. And it goes back to Elizabeth I. It was created to kill her. That's what it was created for. They wanted to get rid of her. And so they created their own spy network to go and kill the Protestant Queen of England. Didn't work, but the entity stayed on. And there's a couple of excellent books on it that people spend a lot of time working and researching it, and I've referenced those in the back in the writer's
note. Yes, you have. Do you think Sir Francis Walsingham set up his own Elizabethan spy network in part as a counter to...
Very possible. Because
I think he might have.
Because the Catholic Church sent agent after agent over there to kill her.
Right.
And he cut it off every time. He was her spy master.
Absolutely.
So they would kind of go at it, and then after that, the entity's been involved in assassinations and many things over the years.
It's probably the secrecy that makes it so enthralling for a thriller writer like you. And you can, to some degree, make stuff up because nobody can disprove it at the same time that a lot of it is factual.
Well, there's a cardinal that runs it. We do know that. They don't reveal his name, so you have no idea who he is. But you have to understand, the Holy See has hundreds of thousands of bishops, priests, lay people all over the globe, and they're reporting everyday information. It's an enormous eyes and ears network around the world, and it's now regarded as the finest intelligence service on the planet.
I love it.
Why does a church need a spy organization? It's interesting, isn't it?
So you've done, what, 5 books set in America?
I did five.
It's like a quintet here within the whole thing. And now you've clearly moved back to an international stage. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, that was my route. That's what I started doing. I did 9 books that way. And then I had these 5 American books that dealt with the Constitution I wanted to deal with. And so I did them. And also it was a way to build the American audience, books that were geared more to the American audience and to build my presence here. And it did. It did build my presence here. But I always knew I'd go back overseas, and so I'm back, and now he's going to stay over there for quite a while, maybe forever. I don't know. May not come back to America for a long time. I have at least 7 or 8 adventures coming with him overseas.
Wonderful. Of course, he's located, or is headquartered in Copenhagen, and his
right.
unlikely spy life as a bookseller.
Yeah,
I love that. Maybe it's an inspiration.
Yeah, I mean, I like it over there, and I think the readers, American readers, like the international aspect of it. International readers certainly like it, and that was my roots anyway.
I've always liked, you know, your China book. Remember how much I enjoyed that?
Emperor's Tomb was good.
Yeah. So you've taken us to some wonderful places.
That was the last international book, and then the next one was Jefferson Key when I switched, and I did the 5 Constitution books. But I'm glad I did. They were fun, and it did work. We built a great American presence.
You did, and you did some very interesting cooperative work with the Smithsonian.
I did. That was when I went on the Smithsonian board, in fact, and I served my 6 years. I'm now an emeritus member of the board. My time, you do 2 terms, and then you're up. And so my time was up, and I enjoyed it, and I got the Lost Order out of it. That's where the book, The Lost Order, came from, for my service there. And I enjoyed serving on the Smithsonian Libraries board.
Well, Nancy, the head of the Smithsonian mm-hmm. Library, is a friend of yours and was an intern. Actually, she was slightly ahead of me as an intern at the Library of Congress. So, you know, it was great. It was all sort of a family thing when we did that,
wasn't it? She's been in charge of that whole operation up there for a long time.
Absolutely. So, give us a hint where your next book is going.
She's headed to Poland. I've always wanted to do a Polish book. I love Poland. He's going to Krakow. He's going down in the salt mines. It's a really interesting story. It's called The Warsaw Protocol, and it will be available a year from now.
When we hope to see you back.
I'll be back. Yes, it's all finished and gone.
Well, thank you, Steve. It was wonderful to talk to you again.